Okay, so we are going to talk about evaluations and the history of evaluations, what people do in different shelters and whatnot. And it is more geared towards shelters than it is towards home, but almost all the things that you can do in a shelter, well, most of them you don't need to do in a home. So for instance, if I go to a home where I know there's resource guarding, I don't have to test for it. I usually can see it. But it's still good to know this kind of stuff if you're doing home stuff as well. So there is a history of evaluations. Many years ago in this galaxy right here, there were no evaluations because animals in shelters were essentially put to sleep. If a dog went to a shelter, the chances were really good that they were not going to make it out of the shelter. And in fact, when Diane Olivato, who used to run the Marine Humane Society, when she started in 1980, what they did then was when a lost dog came into the shelter, if it was a female, they put it to sleep. If it was a male, they made it available for adoption. They didn't want to, they didn't want to spay and neuter. So what they did is they just, killed the females, which of course is not a really good idea when you think about it, because one boy can produce an awful lot more offspring than one girl.
Yeah.
But that's what they did. And so she changed that right away. But it was a very different, in fact, most of us grew up knowing about dog catchers, right? And certainly, it has now become kind of, good idea to adopt from a shelter. In fact, it's the universal excuse now. Oh, don't mind him, he comes from a shelter. He's a rescue dog. That's why he bites. Isn't that right?
Yeah,
we see that all the time now. So the most of the time when I was growing up, you got a dog from your neighbor. You got a dog sometimes from pet stores. People who had money probably got their dogs from breeders, but you certainly didn't get dogs from a shelter. I don't know if that's true of all other countries or just the United States, but I'm pretty sure it was all over the United States. So, as I say, most dogs did not make it up for adoption. There were no statistics kept because it wasn't important. These were throwaway animals. That's what people thought of them as being, and that's what they were. So they were, it was not particularly relevant in the society that we grew up in. So from that point of view, no matter how you look at whether shelters are doing a good job or a bad job, but we are in a more enlightened age because the dogs that go into shelters and the cats that go into shelters, probably to a lesser extent, are deemed as important lives. And that's kind of nice. But there also are some responsibilities that go along with that. So in the 1970s and mostly in the 80s, so it'd be very late 70s, mostly in the 80s, there were shelters sometimes started putting on training classes, because most training classes in the 70s and early 80s were put on by dog training clubs. And there are still some of these clubs around, and they were almost all geared at obedience, as in sit down, come stay, very, very heel, very kind of official, like for competition. And family dog training as a organizational kind of thing didn't start up until probably the mid-80s. So this would be dogs that just didn't pull on the leash, or didn't steal everything off of countertops. Because you can teach a dog, come sit down heel until you're blue in the face, and they'll still get food off the countertops. unless you're training them not to do that. So when shelters started caring a lot and started to start placing appropriate animals, the behavior evaluations were born. And I'm pretty sure that Sue Sternberg was the first person to really do them. And she has never been able to get, her reputation back after some of the things that she said. But she, as far as I know, was the first person to really say, if you're going to put them up for adoption and you're going to put them out there, then you need to know what's going on.
Who is that?
Sue Sternberg. And what happened with her was that she had her own little shelter. I think there were 9 kennels in her shelter. And so she was she lived in upstate New York, and she was bringing these animals in and then putting them up for adoption. And she was doing what anybody else did. She wasn't doing evaluations for them. And one day she adopted out, I think it was a lab mix, I'm not sure, but I think it was a lab mix. And they, the dog, people were really happy with the dog. They thought it was really cute. They put him in the car. The woman had a candy wrapper that had dropped onto the floor of the car. She went to get it and the dog bit her. And so she went, oops. She had no idea that this dog had resource guarding at all. And I know that the first time that we really thought about it at the Marine Humane Society, because we didn't do it when I first started there, was one of the animal care people called to say that there were one of the dogs in the kennel had bitten a had bitten one of the animal care techs in the foot when she was feeding him his food. So I went and got a pooper scooper and put it near him while he was eating his food, and he actually bit into the pooper scooper. He put a hole in the metal of the pooper scooper. And this was because he was a lab, he was a dog that would have gone up for adoption. Because at the time, the dogs that went up for adoption were the dogs that looked okay. The dogs that didn't look okay or growled at you or whatever didn't make it up for adoption. It was just, if it was a lab, it went up for adoption. If it was a pit bull, it didn't go up for adoption. If it was, if there weren't any chihuahuas, the breed didn't even exist. No, it didn't. But there, I don't remember any chihuahuas from when I first started. And I started in 88, I think. So since that time, people have started to really do an awful lot of observation and a lot more handling in shelters and a lot more evaluations in shelters. So it is important to realize how much progress has been made. So this was stuff that we put together a couple of years ago. So it's old, but it's still relevant. This is for the Peninsula Humane Society. In 1970, they euthanized 15,884 dogs. Cats, 21,796, we're for a total of 37,600 animals. That's at the Peninsula Humane Society. No place else, that's just there.
This is on their website.
This is on their website, okay. In 2005, they euthanized 686 dogs, 2020 cats, for a total of 2,706. That's pretty darn amazing.
Yeah.
And if you look at most shelters, particularly urban shelters, I think you're going to find that there's a certain amount of this that has been going on over the years. So we have made huge progress in the amount and number of animals that have been euthanized. And I think that this needs to be, we need to always bear this in mind when people get on your case about, oh, you're euthanizing an animal. Yeah, we're euthanizing an animal where 25 years ago we would have euthanized 300. So that's a big difference. The other thing that has happened over the last 25 years or whatever is that we have volunteers. I mean, there are humane societies have always been run by volunteers, but they didn't necessarily handle the animals. They were out there getting the money, getting donations, and they were involved in the actual adoptions. But they were not necessarily the people who were back there taking care of the animals. Now we have volunteers. Like, how many of you guys actually work with the animals in a shelter or work with the animals? Yeah, right? I mean, and that would be volunteers. That would not be staff. Staff as well, of course. But it's pretty amazing when you think about the number of volunteers that there are now that there didn't used to be before. So before evaluations, how did you make up your mind about whether or not a dog went up for adoption? Cats, I assume it was, I have not dealt with cats that much except for I do consults with cats, or have done consults with cats. But I assume with cats, if it bites you, it doesn't go up for adoption. It's probably about as, and I don't know, handleability is probably pretty relevant as well. But for dogs, they looked at the kennel. If the dog kept hitting the end of the kennel, or spun in the kennel, was a painter in the kennel or whatever, they didn't go up for adoption. And breeds, certain breeds, again, if it's a Rottweiler, didn't go up for adoption, Pitbull didn't go up for adoption. Probably most of the protective dogs had a tendency not to go up for adoption. So the smaller dogs did go up for adoption. Age, I know when I started at Marine Humane, and up until not in that too distant past, if it was over the age of 6 or 7, it did not go up for adoption. When you think about now, we put up for, you know, 10-year-old dogs, and there are shelters, well, like Lily's, where they actually adopt out aging dogs, which is a really cool thing. So when the evaluations were put into place, a lot of shelters saw the recidivism, the return rate, drop, which is great, but there are still not very many shelters that actually do a lot of stats or care that much about it. But so what they got a higher adoption rate, and actually the recidivism rate was a big deal. How many dogs do you get back? Yeah.
Did you see, was it more kind of specific areas of the country? For instance, like I could see the Bay Area. Typically it seems like
urban areas, large urban areas where there was a certain income level, that's where you saw this happen. I think, well, San Francisco, obviously. Los Angeles, no. You know, there's too many animals, and it's too spread out. Also, humane societies run by people, you know, there has to be a really strong person at the center of a humane society for it to be able to make it. And a lot of humane societies 25 years ago were associated with animal controls. But nowadays, it's very rare. You see humane societies and animal control, and they're very separated. San Francisco SPCA used to be associated with animal control, and they split off completely. And so then now they have a little mini wars. And I think that's true a lot with a lot of different shelters. Marin Humane Society is one of the few now still that has its animal control as well as a humane society. And the reason for that is money. Because you can't make a lot of money if you're perceived as a dog catcher, but you can make a lot of money if you're perceived as a heavenly, heavenly bodies coming down. You can. So it means that they do make more money with that. So the first no-kill shelter was announced to the San Francisco SPCA. It was Rich Avanzino, who decided that, you know, you didn't have to kill any animals, which is actually not true. It was the recidivism rate, or the euthanasia rate, as decided by something called the Asilomar Accords, which is a meeting of a whole bunch of humane societies and animal controls, was 10%, right? 10%.
That's the goal.
If you can keep 90% of your animals alive, then you could be called a no-kill shelter. So when somebody calls themselves a no-kill shelter, they still have a euthanasia rate. It's just under 10%. And in order to, this is a funny thing, but in order to make that 10%, sometimes they'll count the weirdest animals, you know, so as to which animals that they got in. But this 10% rate is perceived as some kind of magic number. So if you're 12%, you're a kill shelter. If you're 10%, you're a no-kill shelter. And the perception in the public is that a kill shelter is bad and a no-kill shelter is good. Therefore, kill shelters do not get any money, no-kill shelters get plenty. So you can see that it all comes down to the monetization of the shelters as well. Yeah?
Puts a lot of pressure on.
Puts a ton of pressure on. What's that?
To maybe adopt out animals that really shouldn't be adopted.
Oh yeah, there's that, and there's also counting. What do? They count animals that shouldn't be counted?
Rabbits.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're taken out.
Consideration, like where they, for instance, like a lot of dogs come from the Central Valley, and there's pretty high kill shelters there. But do they not take into consideration like where these shelters are, like the number?
No.
The only thing is the percentage.
It comes down to the number.
Nathan Winograd, who's the head of this movement, feels that it doesn't matter where you are. If you put your resources to getting them adopted out, you can do it.
And he in particularly believes that they're, you know, that all animals can get home.
Well, like, it's a 10%, is it really just a random number?
It's a random number.
Like,
it was the number that they decided was appropriate.
One person just
decided. Yeah, well, it's not one person. It was the Asilomar Accord. So
together.
It was a group of people.
It was led by a.
By the way, the definition is adoptable animals.
Adoptable.
So they're not necessarily, they're discounting those that have reasons for health or for
behavior.
Abnormal behavior. So.
Yeah. But the problem is that nobody is saying what is an abnormal behavior, what is
right,
a behavior.
What's adoptable.
So, you know, there's just a lot of fuzzy stuff going on here. So they just turned off our lights. Is this better?
It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you? Are you okay? Are you like? Do you have enough light?
Yeah, I'm okay. But the I just wanted to know if you guys were. I don't know if they knew that they were turning off.
I'm afraid of the dark.
Hmm? You're not afraid of the dark?
I'm afraid of the
dark. Oh, you're afraid of the dark? Okay, well, just hold the person's hand there. Yeah. Fine. Okay. Okay, so the Asilomar Accords has a lot to do with an awful lot of the politics, or the no hole, no kill thing has a lot to do with all the politics that we have to deal with all the time if you're involved in a shelter at all. Because it starts pitting one department against each other, and there's all kinds of things that can happen. So we were talking about, you're not gonna be able to see this because it's kind of fuzzy, but I think, I don't know what's fuzzy anymore or what's not fuzzy.
That's there.
Okay. All right, so these are shelters. You were asking about the different shelters, okay? This is an open-door, medium-sized suburban shelter with a budget of $10.8 million and an 84% live release rate. Right here. Okay. Now look at this one right here. Open-door, large rural shelter budget is $5.6 million a year, so it's half the budget, and 36% live release rate. Look how many animals they get in.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So, but they still do not, they do not qualify. It's not like.
So the one criteria is it's the number.
Live release. It's live release.
That's it.
And
that's
it's 10%, so define some live release and
not transfer.
Pardon?
They leave the shelter alive.
They should leave the shelter alive.
One way or another.
Okay. Alive.
Even if they come back 10 times?
Yes.
And
even if they've gone, even if they've been sent to Idaho, where we don't know what's going to happen to them.
So if they go to another shelter.
If they go to another shelter.
Yeah, they can be transferred.
It doesn't matter.
That haven't necessarily been vetted.
Is live release considered also going to other shelters?
Yeah.
Yeah, just leaving.
Yeah, they leave your door. They leave the shelter doors alive. So, and this is, yeah.
So the 10% is adoptable
logs? It is supposed to be adoptable, but we don't know the definition of adoptable. It's behavioral or health-wise if they do not reach the criteria for that shelter. So, but they have to have their own criteria. So it's just kind of an interesting thing. And there is a reason I'm talking about all this, is because evaluations have become really, really controversial these days. And one of the reasons they become controversial is because if I, as a behavior evaluator, say, this dog is dangerous, there's a huge push on the other end to say, let's adopt it out anyway.
Yes.
And also, I just would like to add that despite probably the slang you're hearing from us, I don't think that trying to reduce euthanasia is that's a really nice
yes it is
goal.
It's a great goal,
but you know, as always, the pendulum tends to go a little too far, and what's happening is they're not taking into account the people that are being saddled with these animals.
Yeah,
and the animal's quality of life,
and the animal's
quality of life, which is a big deal. But you know what I showed you with the Peninsula Humane Society with the 36,000 animals and reduced. I mean, that is enormous. That is huge. That is really important. And the vast majority of those dogs and those cats are wonderful cats and lived long and happy lives.
Yeah.
So that is, and you have to bear that in mind all the time. It's good that Trisha brought that up because it does sound like I'm like, well, yeah, but, you know, but I'm not. I actually think that evaluations have ended up with more dogs being evaluated than fewer dogs being evaluated. Yeah.
This is probably generally just dogs and cats.
Okay.
And the really relevant stuff is, like, here's a limited intake shelter, so they get to say no to people.
Yeah.
And their budget is $29.5 million a year.
Whoa.
And so, of course, they're going to have a much higher release rate. So this to me is why you cannot compare one shelter to another.
Yeah,
there's no way you can compare Fresno to Marin, for
instance. So, open door shelter means they have to take anything in.
Right. Like Peninsula Humane Society.
Oh, like Marin Humane Society.
They do too.
Yeah.
Right.
You walk in the door and you say, I have this old dog and I want to see it adopted.
So, right? If you have a shelter like the San Francisco SPCA who also adopts out rats and rabbits.
That doesn't count.
That doesn't count toward the live release rate.
So,
I can't actually be sure of that.
I don't think so, though.
I think it's just dogs and cats.
I believe the Selmar Accord was just dogs and cats.
The SPCA doesn't take in animals. Animal Care and Control takes in animals.
Yes. And SPCA essentially says, I want this or I want that. They actually have an agreement with Animal Care. They have an agreement with Animal Care and Control that they will take a certain number of animals.
But they don't take that. You can't go to the San Francisco SPCA and surrender an animal.
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. But you have to make an appointment. And then when you bring them in, they will tell you, I will take it or I won't take it. So, but yet you can't, and with HSSV, same thing. HSSV down in Milpitas, they are open door for one community. I can't remember what the community is. Sunnyvale.
Really?
So they're open door for that one community.
And they pick up strays in Sunnyvale. They have a contract with Sunnyvale.
Yeah, but the rest of it is limited intake. So essentially, if you want your dog to be surrendered there, then you make an appointment and they'll talk to you about it right then and there. Whereas in Oakland and at Marin Humane Society, and certainly all the shelters in the valley, you know, we, Tricia and I were there picking up, I think we got 15 dogs that run that day. So we were going and getting dogs from the Madeira pet, from Madeira shelter. And while we were there, I think maybe 16, 18 dogs came in. So it was like this. And they're barely holding it together. Just really build, you know. If you ever want to, you know, feel like you really want to help, go down to help at Fresno or Madeira or someplace like
you.
That, where they will love you, but then you'll burn out.
Yeah. And then,
because it's so hard. It's so difficult to keep on working. Yeah, for sure.
In Stockton, you still see strays walking in the neighborhood streets.
Yeah.
I go visit my brother in one of the lower income neighborhoods, and they were all over the place. It was, and it's so strange to see
because we don't see that up here.
But some of them are not strays. Some of them are neighborhood dogs, and I know that from a friend who lives in Menlo Park.
Yeah.
She said, "Oh yeah, they're dogs."
Roam.
Well, that's like when I was growing up. That's what our dog did.
Yeah.
Our dog probably fathered him about an awful lot.
he was
certainly
too.
Not fixed.
They're everywhere. They are, and they're all actually. I don't know about all of them, but all the ones I met were pretty friendly.
Yeah.
But when you have a reactive dog, you don't know that all the dogs run around, and it's a little frightening.
Well, the other thing is that a lot of those dogs are very friendly until you try to handle them.
Yeah, I never tried. Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they're not friendly at all. So that is true of an awful lot of dogs that are really comfortable on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have flight distance, you know, which we've talked about at nauseam. So they're, you know, they've got like a 4 to 5 foot flight distance, and you try to get in there and you may not be able to. You're not going to be able to actually do that. So a good evaluation does not only test whether a dog is available for adoption. It also tests who this dog would be appropriate with. You know, is this dog going to be good for a family with children, or is it going to be good for somebody who's very experienced? Is it going to be good for somebody who's athletic? So when you're thinking about an evaluation, it's not just pass-fail, it is where this dog belongs. And I think that sometimes gets lost in some of the evaluation problems that pop up, controversy that pops up. One of the things that happened in the fairly recent past was that the ASPCA started putting out information kind of saying you don't really need to evaluate. And certainly you didn't need to do resource guarding, you didn't need to do this, you didn't need to do that. And personally, I just think that that's kind of putting the responsibility for the animal into the wrong hands. It's putting it into the hands of the adopter after the dog has been adopted. The other thing that's always been interesting to me that has nothing to do with evaluations really is that when you work for a shelter and you're looking for a dog, you get to take one home for a while. Mm-hmm. Or you volunteer, usually you get to take it home and you get to foster it.
Yep.
Most of our adopters, we say, oh no, we want you to make up your mind right away.
It's so true.
You know, you have to make up your mind right away. You have to commit to this dog right away. That's so unfair. It really is unfair.
But
yeah.
Even sometimes they only like get Peninsula Humane, even for people who work there volunteers, it's a couple weeks. And you could take longer than a couple weeks for you to really see who this dog is.
Oh, it does take longer, but at least you get an idea of whether or not the dog wants to kill the cat. Yeah, it's kind of a big deal, you know.
Is this also reasonable because while they're doing the trial adoption, the shelter is still responsible for the vet care and it still owns the dog, so it, they do need to let it go.
So, okay. So here we are. So who do we test? Dogs generally arrive at shelters via stray, surrender, confiscation, court cases, things like that. This particular dog, I don't know if you can see her very well. She was surrendered. She's blind in one eye, and she was, I think this was down the peninsula area somewhere. And she actually went to a foster, then she went to a shelter, then she came back out and went to a foster again, and she actually was eventually placed. So some of these guys have no issues at all, and some may have been given up because life intervened. So one of the problems, actually, all you guys who work and with shelters, so say you have a dog that is not suitable to your home. Just pretend, okay? that you have a dog that is not really suitable to your life. But you either work with a shelter or you're involved with the shelter. Would you?
Oh, but she is so loved.
Fuck off.
She's so loved. Oh.
But would you surrender that dog to your shelter? No, because you'd feel too bad, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You'd feel like, I'm a failure, I can't do that. And I think that a lot of people who have to surrender dogs, period, feel like that. Mm-hmm. I actually have a client that I've spoken about here before who has a very nice Dobie, but it's a bad placement. Mm-hmm. And they are still looking for a home for the Dobie, but they don't want to take the dog to the shelter because they used to volunteer at the shelter. Mm-hmm. And they think that there would be too much bad jujus, you know, about doing that. And I actually think that it might work out okay because it's a nice little Dobie and would probably be snapped up really fast, but it's hard to say. But I know that during in 2008 when we had the Great Recession, there were a lot of people. I'm probably gonna cough, Flocka.
Oh, no, she needs a warning.
Oh, when I cough, she's pretty sure death is going to follow imminently. It does not have anything to do with when Trisha coughs, everything is fine.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So.
Makes perfect sense to me.
So anyway, we got an awful lot of dogs in because of, you know, people couldn't find homes that would accept animals, and which is still a big problem. It's really hard to find a place to rent where they'll accept dogs, and then where they might accept one kind of dog, but they won't accept another kind of dog, or maybe you have two dogs.
Or you have three.
Or three, yeah. And unless you have three dogs that all look exactly the same, it's a problem. No, this is just my dog. This is the same dog, yeah. So you get, people have to give up their animals, or sometimes they're surrendered for behavior reasons, and one of the problems is that a lot of times when they're surrendered for behavior reasons, they don't tell you the behavior reason because they don't want the dog to be euthanized. And particularly if it's a really serious one, they don't want to say, well, I'm sorry, but he bites, because then they figure that he's not going to have much of a chance. And if it's a limited intake shelter, then you won't take him. So they lie. And they just, you know, kind of skate around the truth. But even problems like marking can be a reason for a shelter, for a dog not to be adopted. So because many dogs mark, and that's, I think the only reason we can have pets is because dogs can be house trained. Otherwise, we would have outside animals, and they certainly wouldn't be part of our lives. But because they can be house trained, we can have them as pets. So if you have a dog that marks or has real severe issues with, maybe spay incontinence or something like that, a lot of times that makes them not very adoptable. So what we're trying to do with the behavior evaluation is to find out what potential problems a dog might have. So you're not just trying to find out what problems they have right now, or what they have in the shelter. You're actually trying to figure out what is the potential for an issue down the road. And we're not really gods, and we really cannot see everything. So it's always fun to have a dog that you've evaluated as problematic. The people come back later and go, he was no problem. You were totally wrong. And they're very happy that I'm happy to be totally wrong in that case. And sometimes you're totally right. So you're making best guesses based on all your expertise and the amount of time that you can put into it. One of the things that's been happening recently is that the evaluations have a time limit. And when you have a very overcrowded shelter, you have to have a time limit. But if you don't have an overcrowded shelter and you have a kind of a perceived time limit of you have to do this in 15 minutes, that's kind of making a life or death decision based on a very little bit of time and a little bit of observation. And so I think as much time as you can give an evaluation, the better off you are. So shelter volunteers a lot of times, or certainly fosters, sometimes don't see problems because they don't ever push the dog. So if you're an evaluator, and I know that we've been criticized because you know you're going to push the dog a little bit more. So you don't just kind of accept who they present to themselves, you actually do things that they don't like very much, like touch feet or whatever. And the reason you're doing that is to see how the dog responds potentially to something. Because, you know, if the dog doesn't like being handled and you have to pick it up, I mean, you could probably dance around it and just try to make the dog do what you want the dog to do without handling it, but if he doesn't like to be handled and he bites you, that is a potential issue. In fact, as we were coming here, I got an email from somebody who has, it's another healer, I'm sorry.
Oh,
no. I don't mean to say it's another healer. And we had a follow-up appointment like for 2 weeks down the road, and she said the dog just bit her husband in the face, so can we make it earlier? And I'm like, yeah, although I'm not terribly sure what I'm going to do. Yeah. I'm going to go in and go, yeah, the dog bit you. Yeah, you're right, the dog bit you. It was presumably that the guy was doing something the dog didn't like. And if you only do the things that the dog likes, you're not going to see the issues. And again, a lot of times volunteers, particularly in some shelters, will not see anything at all. And fosters often don't see very much because they have a lot of dogs and they don't have the time or maybe even the inclination to do things that the dog doesn't like. If you try to do Aspen's nails, she screams bloody murder and she actually will try to bite you,
yep.
Which is actually not that abnormal with dogs, any dog. And so what do we do as owners? We say, oh, let's let the groomer take care of that.
That's what we do.
Or let's let the vet take care of that. And poor vets are like, oh my God, we got to wrap this dog up in order to do its nails.
Do you find that if you try to do your nails yourself, that it kind of comes between your guys' relationship, the trust?
If you have a new dog and you're doing their nails, then yeah, you can actually break trust. Then the trust is really tentative to begin with, so you can actually do that. So yeah, handing it off to somebody else might be a good idea at that point, because you go, oh, baby!
You get to be the good guy.
Did that nasty, horrible person just do your nails? Yeah, you can certainly do that. With Flocka, who does not like her nails done, we just use a calming cap and boom, no problem at all. So if you guys ever want to try that, that's really an easy way to do nails. You just put it on top of their head, they can't see, and they go, okay, I guess you're going to do this to me. So we do that with Aspen, too, although she's going, nah, 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 the whole time. Does not like it. Also, every time you buy a calming cap, I get about 35 cents, I think. So, actually, I think I get 3 cents, but yeah, what the heck. What you're doing in an evaluation is you're pushing for something so that you can see something that might show up later, or that you want to tell people, okay, in order to work with this dog, I would suggest that you start slow in this area. And what a nice thing for a potential owner to know, that, this is an area where you might want to go slowly with the dog. So you're also not being a trainer. And I've seen a lot of trainers do evaluations, and they don't do evaluations the way you should do them, or at least the way I think you should do them, which is by a lot of observation and some handling and whatnot, where you act like you're kind of an idiot at first, and then you kind of get more and more expert as time goes on. But you can say, okay, if the dog is doing something that is not good, you can also think, okay, well, this would work with behavior modification. We can actually make some headway here. And those are things that are important too. So having a person who's a trainer and an evaluator is oftentimes a good thing. It's just that when you're first doing your evaluation, you shouldn't be thinking in terms of modifying the behavior in the very beginning. It kind of is something that happens a little bit further on. And again, you're looking for an appropriate home for this dog. This dog here was a feral dog that had been placed in a home that was not expecting a feral dog. And they had to decide whether or not they could keep the dog because they had a lot of grandchildren running in and out of the house, and this dog did not like grandchildren at all. I don't know what they decided to do. So a lot of issues can't be worked on safely, and not all behavior modification will work. And I know we've been talking about this over the weeks, but essentially, or months or years, that all organisms have a tendency to go back to their comfort zone. So when you do behavior modification, your clients often think that behavior modification is something that you do one time and then everything's going to be okay later. When in reality, what happens is the behavior that the dog is doing is the preferred behavior. That's what has worked for them. If they snap when you put your hand on their paw and you stop putting your hand on their paw, that is a working behavior. Now, to do behavior modification, you might be doing some desensitization and counter conditioning, or you might be doing some training. But if you stop doing that, then they'll float back to their comfort zone and they'll return to that. So when you're working on behavior mod, this is what happened at a shelter that was doing behavior modification on aggressive dogs. So I believe this was mostly dog-aggressive dogs, but I'm not absolutely sure. It could also be people-aggressive dogs. So they were doing a lot of work on trying to modify the behavior of these aggressive dogs. So they would do a lot of desensitization and counter-conditioning. They did play groups. They did all kinds of stuff to try to help these dogs. And then they put these dogs out, and they put them up for adoption. And there was a caveat on the adopter's agreement saying, this dog had shown reactivity issues or aggressive behavior issues, and this is what you need to do to keep on top of it. But of course, the people getting the dog go, I don't see any behavior issues, right? They didn't see anything at all, so why would they work on it? Because they're not seeing anything. It's not like they were the ones doing the behavior mod. So what happened was almost all these dogs came back after biting somebody because nobody worked on the behavior mod. And people just took them. So if you're trying to work on something and it's a pretty dangerous thing, you have to realize that you're working on something that's dangerous, and that means that probably you should adopt the dog and not somebody else. That makes sense? Yeah, but for a while, I think Michigan was trying to do it and a few other places were trying to do it. And now, I don't know if they are. San Francisco, for sure, is trying to do it. Because they figured that somehow or other they thought that behavior modification is permanent. But we all know that the only consistent thing about behavior is that it always changes. And it will revert.
You're saying that the shelters were doing the behavior mod uh-huh. and they'd get adopted.
Yeah. And in fact, people when I was at Marin, they would go, oh, you guys do a lot of behavior mod. And we never did very much. First of all, the volunteers pretty much wanted to talk to each other most of the time. rather than actually working with the dogs. But that's just, you know, I did too. So, But more than that is if you do too much, if you can do sit and come and down and stay, those are fine. That's obedience. Also, that goes away too, isn't it? They go home and they go, oh, look what I can get away with here. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is good. But if you're trying to make a dog that is predatory, stop being predatory in a kennel environment, in a shelter environment, forget it. It's not going to work. And I think most behavior mod doesn't work. And maybe that's me being lazy. I don't know. But I actually think that that's true. I keep expecting her to say more. She's usually much more talkative.
I'm just biding my time. Yeah. When she keeps telling you all these incorrect things, I'll eventually.
I got this thing on my shoulder. Okay, so what are we looking for? What is a normal family dog?
This dog.
Belongs to a friend of mine. Oh. Actually, it doesn't. It belongs to one of her clients.
Doesn't
And it was a little snappy, horrible dog.
But it's so cute.
Doesn't it look cute?
It was so cute.
Yes, well, you know, beware of the Spitz effect. Right, Aspen? She has two brothers, both of who are twice as large as her, and they have some pretty serious behavior problems.
So she was the runt?
No, she was the diva.
You showed us those pictures of them when they were puppies.
Yeah.
And she was considerably
smaller.
Smaller.
Yes, and she definitely is smaller. She was, I would hate, we've never called her a runt, though. You know, that would be really, yeah, I would say so, for sure. Okay, so normal family dog, the thing that most people, when they go looking for a dog, I was at Pet Food Express yesterday, and they had an event, mm-hmm. and so I was walking by the dogs, and I would say that like eight, ten dogs there, maybe two were what you would consider normal, the rest were fearful, or they were barking at everybody going by, or whatever, but anyway. But friendly, that's a big deal, right? Friendly dog is, you can get away with a lot if you got a friendly dog. Mm-hmm. Tolerant, can handle being handled. That, again, is really, really important. One of the dogs that I saw this past week was really intolerant to handling, and any kind of handling from anybody in the family. It was a poodle, and owned by a couple in their 70s, and they had him since he was 8 weeks old, and he had bitten the wife several times. She wouldn't touch him. When I got over there, she said, "No, I don't touch this dog." So I talked him into returning the dog to the breeder, I think. They may change their mind. But
how
that
old is the dog?
Two. And it comes from hunting lines, and it's got, there's too much dog there for them. But I shouldn't say this, but I really didn't like the dog. I didn't like the dog because of the way he looked at me. It was very assessing. Kind of like, what can I get out of you? And what do I not have to give to you? Not at all giving, not at all easy to, you know, desirous of pleasing or anything like that. He's like a you know, just a really not a nice animal.
Is it a mini or a standard?
Standard.
Okay. It's a big dog.
Yeah, it's a big guy. And very pretty, but, you know, you can't touch him. They said the explanation of the behavior problem, you know, and it was that he goes up to people as though he wants to get petted, and as soon as they start to pet him, he bites them.
Oh.
So, you know, that's not a really nice
kind of okay.
So they're lucky. A lot of people that I see, a lot of clients are lucky that nobody has taken them to court, or they, you know,
or gotten really hurt.
Oh, good. Well, they. She had stitches.
Oh.
She had like 19 stitches in her hand.
Oh, okay, never mind.
So yeah, that's why she won't touch him at all. But he would come up to me, and I'm just like acting like, you know, I have floppy hands. Nobody, I'm not gonna. And he got ticked off, but then he'd go over and pay attention to the husband. Gentle with mouth and paws. So this would be a dog that doesn't bite, and jump up on you and bite you, you know, in play. That's something that people really like. The other thing that's really interesting about owners or people who want a dog is they think a dog that is not gentle with mouth and paws is abnormal. And we know that that's totally not true, right? That's actually a normal dog. And dogs that jump on you, you know, that's normal. But owners think that that's abnormal. I have to stop that behavior. That's a bad behavior. So they don't think that's normal. So there's an awful lot that that people think are completely.
Do you think it's because they don't like it? They just assume it's.
Well, I think that you know, that people have an expectation that dogs don't do that.
Yeah.
And so when they do that, then they think that there's something wrong with the dog. And I always think it's really funny with a little bitty dog. They don't like it either, you know. And I'm like, how are they supposed to get to you?
Yeah.
You know, they want to get up here somewhere. So I that's not anything that I ever want to work on with little dogs. Able to settle alone. That's a really big deal, isn't it? Can the dog actually settle down when you have left? Because no matter how much of a homebody you are, people leave. You go out to the store. And sometimes it's too hot to put your dog in the car. or whatever, you know. And the inability to settle alone is a very, very big deal. It's the reason why Strider went through 6 homes before he got to my home. And an awful lot of dogs with separation anxiety don't make it. And yet they are amongst the sweetest, nicest dogs ever put on earth, because they just love you to pieces. Just don't want you to ever leave anywhere. Good with other pets. Don't want to kill the cat, that's a, you know, or the rabbit, or whatever. And people, again, have some interesting expectations with that in that area. There was the case of the Akitas that killed the chickens, and they were going to put them to sleep because they were aggressive. For killing a chicken. And, you know, like, we kill chickens all the time. We're not put to sleep for killing a chicken. Healthy. And those are, and then not too energetic. What else do people want? They want the dog that can, that wants to go for a walk when they want to go for a walk.
Very potty trained.
But as soon as they come home, they want them to settle down. Potty trained, that's a really big deal. What else do people want in a dog?
They don't surf the counters.
Pardon?
They don't surf the counters.
And they know that they're not supposed to surf the counters right away.
Not just all other people and all other dogs.
Yeah, just
friendly, I guess, at the end of it. Just
yeah, just loves everybody,
okay,
but knows the difference between a burglar and a friend.
It's okay to have people and kids put their hands all over them.
Right.
I guess that's tolerant, but kids can just do whatever they want. The dog is fine.
Yep. So, we have our expectations. Trisha and I have often said our expectations of dogs are way higher than they are of people. And our expectations of strange dogs, because a lot of the requests we get are for, I want to be able to go to a coffee shop in Sausalito and have my dog sit out underneath
lay down.
And the dog is like, nah, this is mine. You know, and one of the things we'll say is, well, maybe you should go to the coffee shop alone.
Yeah.
Oh, but I want to take the dog.
Well,
you want a lot of things in life.
Yeah, I know.
You want $1 million. That doesn't mean you should get it.
I have a customer whose dog has bitten a couple of people while he's sitting out at a cafe. And they're like, maybe you should take the dog to the cafe. He's like, oh, yeah. And I saw him this weekend at the cafe.
With the
dog sitting outside. And I'm like,
and, you know, you can say put a muzzle on the dog, but they don't want to put a muzzle on the dog.
No,
they're just going to sit and hope that he doesn't bite the next person who comes by.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I think a big thing is that people think all dogs should want to walk. And I see that with clients, and I'm like, I think it's a good idea that this dog, you do other things with this dog, like Emmy. Like, she's this golden that I walk. And she's really, like, anxious about tons of things. And they still think she should be able to walk.
We have an interesting society right now, because not only do people think dogs should be like this, but they also think that there are certain things that dogs are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And go for walks twice a day is one of those things. And there's no supposed to. In fact, I was talking to somebody who was just really upset because their neighbor doesn't walk the dog. And in this case, I don't think the dog wants to be walked.
Right.
Nor do I think the entire neighborhood would be safe if he was walked. So, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. So my criteria is, would I recommend this dog to my next door neighbor or to my sister or brother?
Yeah.
So if I would really like to pass this dog, but I want to send him to the next county, there's something wrong. And yet, I bet we do this sometimes, you know. As long as he's not in my backyard. It's that NIMBY, right? I don't want this dog in my backyard. Because, I mean, you get some of these dogs that are so energetic or so noisy or whatever. And you know, we don't want to be living next to them, especially if we already live with a noisy dog. No, we don't live with a noisy dog.
No.
Okay. So evaluations cannot tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, but they give you a glimpse into the personality of the dog and the potential problems. And I don't know if I make this clear in other areas, but we've talked about this before. One of the most important things that a shelter management can do is pay attention to what the volunteers say about the dogs that they're walking on a regular basis, because your evaluation is going to be 20, 25 minutes long or whatever, but the people walking the dogs every day, they're going to see more things, and they're going to see deterioration or they're going to see improvement, and those are things that are really important. Yeah?
I've saw the opposite at the shelter I used to work at, where some of the volunteers would withhold information.
Oh, yes.
They
like the dog, they don't want to see, they don't want to be responsible for the dog, actually.
So, I mean, one volunteer was walking a dog, and the dog had been basically kind of like kennel crazy. She was there too long, and this was a dog that she would walk and I would say hi to every day. And all of a sudden, the dog went to greet me, and all of a sudden, just started just what to lunge at me. And this is like an older lady, I was like, oh god, you know? Anyway, she didn't even report it, the dog went to lunge and attacked me, and I turned around. Thankfully, she, actually did have a hold of the dog. And, I assume that she reported that, because that's what volunteers do, and to find out that there was a previous incident with this dog, and that person, the animal control officer, didn't want to say anything.
Yeah,
and,
you get that all the time.
Ask the other animal control officers, did anyone else have any issues with this dog, and that's how it came about. And, that volunteer, never spoke to me again.
No,
I'm the devil.
Because they do not want to be responsible
for that. She didn't see it as a dog coming at me to, and that was the worst part of it. It was a dog that was unpredictable. This dog, was so nice to me and everybody. And all of a sudden, and was having its tail coming towards me, to say hi. And then all of a sudden, something just snapped and the dog just went to, which is makes it even worse. Like, how do you adopt a dog out to somebody like that? I mean, hello.
They do that all the time.
Right, it's what you were saying earlier, you should take this dog home, to the volunteer.
Yes, of course, if we took all the dogs home that we knew we should take home, we probably would all of us have a kennel. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think, and obviously the volunteers don't want to be responsible for any part in a euthanasia decision. So you can understand where they're coming from, especially if they have grown attached to a particular dog or something. On the other hand, some of them actually will, if you read between the lines, will tell you stuff. If you actually listen carefully, they may be trying to hide stuff. And again, that's so understandable as far as I'm concerned. But they also may tell you stuff. There are also some volunteers who do feel just as much commitment to the public as they do to the dogs, and you have to listen to those. The evaluation thing is an ongoing process. And like when I was at Marin and then at Santa Cruz, I was in an office where I could watch the volunteers. At Marin, I could watch the volunteers and their interaction with the dogs from my office, and they didn't know that I was watching it. And at Santa Cruz, I probably have gone mostly deaf, but I was situated right in the kennels. My office was right in the kennels, so I could watch the volunteers taking them out and stuff. So there is some of that, but it's really, really hard because you do have to listen. You do have to keep assessing them as they stay in the shelter. You do have to listen to your volunteers, and you do have to listen to the staff that's feeding them and stuff. And they're all going to have their bias, and yet you have to really, really read between the lines.
The other thing is, I think that from the point of view of being a volunteer, if you actually, when training volunteers, if you say, look, we're interested in making sure that the public is safe as well as you, and we will not, if you see something that's bothersome to you, we will not use just your word for it, but we would like to take the dog out and maybe do another reevaluation on it. And that would be understanding of the fact that the volunteer does not want to be responsible for the euthanasia of an animal, but at the same time knows that they're seeing things that could be problematic, like a dog that is unpredictably aggressive, which is pretty darn scary. Yeah.
Another thing, it's important for them for you to meet with the volunteers frequently, because what they're not seeing is that if you adopt out a dog that ends up biting somebody in the neighborhood, a kid, sends them to the ER, there's a whole circle of people that are never going to go to a shelter again.
Exactly.
And so then you're jeopardizing the future dogs that are coming in.
Yeah. One of the things that I used to do at Marin was the evaluators had to assist at consultations. Or observe consultations, because an evaluator evaluates a dog and then the dog is gone. It goes adopted, it comes back, and we did free post-adopt consults. And so then they would actually see what some of the dogs that they were evaluating as being okay were like in a home. So that was part of that circle that Trish is talking about, and that's a Those are really important circles to keep everybody in the loop all the time. Yeah.
When shelters get puppies in, are they more or less likely to evaluate them? And I ask that.
Oh, I would say that the vast majority of shelters don't do much in the way of evaluating puppies, unless the puppy is really abnormally something.
I asked that because I saw, before I adopted our puppy, I saw some shepherd puppies that had come in, and they obviously had some, they were a little bit emaciated. I saw them like kind of after hours, and they had a couple of them had severe like resource guarding from the other puppies that were in their litter, and I reported it. I said, hey, you guys need to, they were gone within a day and a half. And I thought,
Just to let you know, the number of puppies that are resource guarders in their litter is really high.
So
you take them out of their litter,
and
it does not necessarily follow
that
they are their resource guarders outside
of the litter. Because I got really worried about it, but they were gone.
Part of that is that we cause it by trying to feed the litter all in one
together.
They were all competing, but they were all together.
And they get all snarly and everything.
Yeah.
So this is one of the reasons why, if you're going to do it with puppies, you have to do them separately, and you probably should do them two or three times, because they keep on going through changes. And that's one of the reasons why probably most shelters don't actually do a lot in the way of behavior evaluation. But as somebody here can tell you, puppies are really different in their litter, right? And so if you see signs like what, Dakota?
Yeah.
Yeah, like Dakota's behavior, that those, when you're evaluating, those are really good things to kind of, you know, stand up and take notice. This is what's going on. How is Dakota?
So much better.
Good.
But she'll never be
normal.
And thank goodness that we have her.
Yeah. And so she did what you should do. If you see these kind of behavior problems, you adopt the dog yourself.
And call you.
Yeah,
yeah, well.
That's awesome.
Okay. So evaluations, testing shows how the dog responds to stress in the run with strangers, with a schedule that does not take individual variations into consideration. So whenever you're doing an evaluation, those are the things you have to bear in mind. This is an abnormal situation. It would be like us getting an evaluation after, you know, we're in prison. And we may not behave the way we would at home if we're in prison. But you're still going to see some really overt behavior problems with some of the dogs. So you can see whether the dog has outstanding issues that would make him unadoptable, and with handling and aggression. So if a dog bites you, it probably shouldn't go up for adoption. Now, having said that, I can say that probably people go, oh, but he's stressed, and that's why he's biting. Well, actually, that's what he does when he's stressed. And stress happens.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that the dog is doing it because he's stressed should be telling you something besides ouch. You know, it may be that the dog really does respond to stress by being inappropriate or by biting, you know. And any kind of dog aggression is always an interesting one, because our dog Luke is somewhat aggressive or reactive, certainly, to other dogs, and he has gotten to a couple of tussles, but he gets along really well with dogs in his household.
Yeah.
You know, so these are things that are
But speaking of Luke,
There he is.
He has been an anchor around our necks for 13 years.
Yes. He has. We can't go anywhere with him, you know. And,
but he loves you.
Yes, he loves us.
You lucky boy.
So why you were fostering Luke, right?
Yeah, we fostered him, and then he became ours, and it was a misunderstanding.
I'm sure that's what happened.
In retrospect,
he had distemper as a pup, which is why we were fostering him, because he was sick. It turns out it was distemper, and he's got some screws loose.
Yes, he definitely has some screws loose. But but he's a very handsome dog.
He's
very, 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 very good looking. But if, you know, handsome can be a jerk too, you know. So. But again, you know, he would have shown, if he were an adult when he was in the kennel, he would have shown some really pretty serious reactivity in the run and probably towards dogs if he was on leash. And yet when you get him into a home, he got along really well with all the other dogs we've ever had. He's gotten along really, he's taken a little while to get to know them, but even like my daughter's dog and stuff like that. So dog aggression is an interesting thing. I have a friend who always said, she worked for Denver Dumb Friends League for a long time, and she always said that, you know, dogs with dog reactivity, they would put them up for adoption, having said that the dog was reactive. But then her own dog was attacked by a dog that had been adopted from a shelter and was reactive, and in the process of being attacked, she was bitten, the owner of the other dog was bitten, her dog was totally traumatized, and so she changed her mind. She said, you know, if we're adopting out dogs that are more than reactive, particularly if they're actually aggressive, we're not doing anybody a service here, because these dogs are can be menaces when they're on the street. And she had a point, you know. Testing does not show whether a dog is overly territorial. Oh my goodness, that's such a big deal. Because territoriality exists, and it is pervasive everywhere. Almost all, 90% of dogs probably are pretty territorial. And some dogs are overly territorial and will attack. I had a client once whose dog, a German Shepherd, went through their screen door and attacked a guy on the other side of the street getting into his car with his kid. Luckily, they were not injured, but the fact is that, I mean, he threw the kid up on top of the car, and then he climbed up there himself. But that was such a high degree of territoriality that was kind of really amazing. Whether a dog might tend to show social dominance in the home. The poodle I was talking about, besides being intolerant, I think he was also socially dominant. He was trying to run everything in the house, and they were letting him, because there's nothing like being threatened, you know, to say, okay, whatever you want to do,
it's
fine with me. It's like the people with the wolf hybrid. How do you live with this wolf hybrid? We let them do anything they want.
Yeah.
Yep, they go anywhere they want to. They do anything they want to. So that would be socially dominant. And whether the dog might be appropriate with other animals in the household. So one of the issues, of course, is cats, because a dog might even test out fine with cats in a shelter environment, and go home and be awful, and what I've seen a lot is be awful with one of the cats in the house and fine with the other one, depending on whether or not one of the cats is a scaredy cat and the other one is like one who comes up and goes, you're out of here. So those are things that may or may not, and also pack behavior. So lots and lots of people have more than one dog now. So you actually get a dog, and he behaves in a certain way in the shelter. You get him into your home, and he's surrounded by a lot of other dogs, and he goes, boy, I am empowered. I can do anything I darn well want to. And so those are things that you are not going to see in a shelter environment, and you're not going to see when you're doing an evaluation, and you have to be very much aware of that. So if we don't test, we make these arbitrary decisions, so you know, you probably need to test. It's probably a good idea. Should you test little dogs as well as big dogs? Yes. Puppies? Yes, if you can. Yeah?
What do you think about shelters that don't test dogs with other dogs?
What do I think about shelters that don't test dogs with other dogs? I think they're missing out an opportunity to find some interesting information.
Okay.
Again, if you think of this as being life or death decisions, maybe that shouldn't be the life or death decision, but there are shelters that won't, they tell their potential adopters, don't bring your other dogs in. So they don't do a test with the other dogs in the household. Isn't there one or two that do that?
There's a whole bunch now, because SPCA is advocating.
Oh yeah, because they can't tell for sure whether they're gonna get along really well, so just don't do it at all.
So scary.
Which is very much like, don't take an aspirin because we're not absolutely sure it's gonna do any good.
Yeah.
You know, just because it does good with some dogs, or just that doesn't mean it's gonna do good with all dogs. So that is actually one of the biggest arguments against evaluations. There has been no proof, empirical proof, that they are absolutely predictive of future behavior. No, there isn't. You're right. There's no proof. Does that mean we go, oh, well, gosh, then we just won't do it? You know, because there's no proof that it works, so we just won't do it.
You could also have the issue where the dog seems fine. You know, you have them meet, obviously there's not a perfect eval, but then you could get home, and then the dog
in the house,
like,
totally different.
Oh, yeah, you were going to bring that dog home? I didn't know the dog was going to come home.
Like, it was okay out there.
Take that dog out of here.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, and that happens actually quite a bit.
Yeah.
I hit the one that I remember really well was the people who adopted a rather aloof No, they had an aloof husky at home, and they adopted this really social husky. And so they brought the dog home, and the aloof, the one at home, was like, no, I don't want any, you know. And she proceeded to try to tell him he couldn't live there. She wouldn't let him come in the door, and if he was outside, she wouldn't let him go outside. If he was inside, she wouldn't let him near his food. She, you know, she never wanted affection from the owners, but if they gave him affection, she wanted all the affection. And she essentially had kind of attacked him several times. And they came in for a consult, and they said, we don't know what to do because we really like the boy dog, the new dog, better than the old dog.
Oh.
You know, and I actually don't blame him. He was probably a nicer dog. I can't remember what happened to them. I think probably they brought the old dog again. Yeah. They just did a little switch. Because it was not going to work the way it was. At all. What would you do in a situation like that? Isn't this an interesting kind of, you know, ethical quandary?
Yeah.
But the old dog was there first.
Yes, the old dog is the resident dog, and so should have a lot more rights.
Yes.
The new dog can be adopted out easier.
The new dog could be.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Could be.
Sure.
You just keep them both, and only the resident dog.
Yeah, but if they fight each other and they're miserable.
If they fight, I mean.
Well, what if they don't fight, but the dog you just adopted is now miserable.
Yeah.
And kind of walks around like, you know. So you got that issue too.
Yeah, it just depends on the dogs. And like with my two, one is not overly affiliated with people or, you know, other dogs. She likes to play with me.
But they get along.
They get along, but the one who is the friendliest, the one who's like, you know, the dog you want around and interacts with you, is the new dog.
Right. Well, I mean, that's why one of the reasons why we all have multiple dogs is you're getting something out of this dog, but you're going to get something else out of that dog. You could do that with husbands or whatever. You know? So, you know, but probably people did that with children. Well, this child I want to be a doctor, and this child I want to be a lawyer, and this child I want to, you know, but... I mean, you know, we want an Aussie. We really would like another Aussie because we're partial to them, particularly Trisha is partial to them. We're not going to throw away our other dogs, and our Aussie would have to get along, but we would really like, and because they're different, you know. Flocka, she's not getting one just yet. It's okay.
I think I already hear about it.
Okay, so intake evaluations. Dogs act very differently when they're with their guardians than away from them. So if this is actually really good for people who are in-home trainers or whatever. So if you would like to find out, if somebody is thinking maybe they want to not keep this dog or whatever, then having the actual owner of the dog do some of the things that you would do as an evaluator is a really good way to find out what's going on. So if you had somebody relinquishing their dog at your door, then asking them to do some of this stuff would be really good. So for instance, you could approach the dog and try to pet the dog on top of the head, and then you ask the owner of the dog to do the same thing. Because what you're trying to find out is how the dog likes strangers, but how it likes its owner when it has bonded. You know? Now of course this is really hard if you've got a weeping owner, you know. So sometimes you just can't do it. But if you can, it's a nice thing to do, to actually have them do something. And have them look at the dog's teeth and pick up the dog's feet. All those things that, as soon as the dog becomes very fearful, they want to protect themselves. And they don't want you to do these things because they're not sure who you are, if you're, you know, you're going to kill them momentarily or whatever. So if you have the owner do that, it's a really good idea. And then you try to do it yourself by taking the dog away from the guardian and doing it yourself. Now, there are dogs that are going to be much better with the guardian, and there are dogs that are going to be much worse with the guardian. And you have to be the one figuring out what, you know, whether or not the dog is better or worse. You know, the dog that the vet says, we'll take the dog in the back, you know, and separate them from the owner. Those are usually dogs that do much better when they're apart from the owner. And then there are the, I mean, when I had Rottweilers, my vet would go, no, you're coming in the back with us. Because they would work for me, but they would not do it for anybody else. As far as they were concerned, they just weren't going to.
By the way, Just to sort of highlight some of the limitations of the evals, we not too long ago fostered a little, you know, remember the little gray terrier, long-haired gray terrier?
Yeah.
And she had puppies in the shelter, and when I brought her home, we couldn't touch her, they couldn't touch her in the shelter. When I needed to take her out to pee and stuff, I had to actually lasso her over the X-pen and take her out because she really went for me and stuff. And then over time, after a few days, she realized, okay, I'm not there to harm you, I'm going to trust you. And eventually became so attached to us. I could go and put her in the tub and wash her, and she would just let me do anything. And the minute I took her back to the shelter to get adopted out, people who, again, tried to pick her up, she said, no, we can't do it. So until she actually developed a relationship, she was very suspicious and unable to let somebody handle her. And because we were quite attached, except that she was a barker and there's no way.
We didn't have none of
that.
But we were there to help transition her to the new person, even though she did snap at the new person, you know, a few times, but she adjusted and adapted. So again, this is a shortcoming of the whole evaluation process. And with intake evaluations, most shelters, I would venture to say, are not able to sit and interview the open door shelters, are not able to interview the people who are bringing the dog in and observe the interaction with the owner and stuff. So this is for shelters that actually have enough resources and enough staff, and the limited intakes, they generally do interviews before they take a surrender, because they will say no if they have
But a limited intake, I don't think they have them do much handling. I don't know whether they do or not. But if they don't, they should. Because it's really, I think it's really important. I remember that, we couldn't handle her at all until she started trusting us, and then she was okay. You know, when you think about it, one of the things that happens at shelters, pretty much all shelters, is that the dogs are handled by a wide variety of people. It's not just one person. So if you had a dog like this that came in and you could actually have one person who could handle the dog, you could probably really find out how the dog would respond in a home with somebody who, you know, they could trust. But it's, you know, it depends on how many dogs come through your system, what kind of resources you have. One of the things that a shelter that in the East Bay used to do that they don't do anymore was they had employees that they would assign certain dogs to, which is really a cool idea, you know. And those employees were supposed to take the dogs out for walking them and playing with them and grooming them and all that kind of stuff. So they actually did get a relationship going in the shelter. I don't know what happened. I think probably it was too hard to keep up and they stopped doing it. But it was a good idea. This little dog here, I actually kind of remember this dog because we couldn't take that off at all because it wouldn't let you take it off. He came in with it on and you couldn't take it off. Cute little thing, isn't he? So then you would make a decision in your intake on, you know, just probably a preliminary decision as to whether or not this dog is okay for, you know, for who to handle, you know, what volunteers to handle. Now at Santa Cruz, all the volunteers handled all the dogs, essentially. But at Marin and other shelters, they have particular volunteers that can handle particular dogs. And at an intake eval, you might actually decide, you know, these are the people that can handle this dog or whatever. So okay, I'm actually going to finish this and then go to aging and sexing. So other than puppies, dogs should be in the shelter for 3 days or more so they become acclimated to their life. It must be awful to be evaluated on the first day you come in when you don't know what the routines are. And as far as the dog is concerned, their life may be ending at any moment. And for a dog, there is no purpose in life except living. So they would like to keep on living. As far as they're concerned, this is important. We know that stress, cortisol levels drop after 3 days, and that's something that should be borne in mind if at all possible. On the other hand, dogs that are housed right next to a whole bunch of other barking really loud dogs, their stress levels are probably going to stay up there for a while. There's not much you can do about it. It's not like shelters are quiet, calm places to be. In fact, there are shelters that are, like San Francisco and the Peninsula, the New Peninsula Humane Society, and they're too isolated. They're so quiet that they're like probably like being, you know, anybody here have a noise-sensitive dog?
Mm-hmm.
So everything is quite quiet and calm, and then something happens, and it just the dog either starts barking like crazy or shoots underneath a chair or something like that. I think some of these shelters that are so quiet are like that. It's likely you're going to get some noise-sensitive dogs in there. So anyway, after 3 days, they understand their routines, and they can start predicting that they actually are going to live another day, which is probably a good thing. So then you can start evaluating them after that. In a perfect world, an evaluator should not have formed a relationship with this dog, because at this point, what we're trying to do is find out how the dog is with strangers. You can, and certainly do, establish a relationship with the dog afterwards, but in the beginning, you're kind of a little bit aloof, and you're just trying to see how the dog is when it's with someone they don't know. Should start the evaluations with as few preconceptions as possible. Essentially, this means that you don't go in going, oh, I hate Rottweilers. And if you go in saying that, maybe somebody else should do the eval. Because if you really don't like that kind of dog, or I can't stand Chihuahuas, or whatever, then either you can put that to the side, or if you can't put that to the side, then you have to bear in mind that you've got this prejudice, or have somebody else do it. And should have enough experience with dogs that the dog that they can start trusting their own instincts. So this is anybody heard of the SAFER test? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one that's used all over the place. And what Emily was doing for a long time, I don't think she does it anymore, is she was actually certifying people in the SAFER test. So essentially they would learn how to do the SAFER test, which is a fairly short form of an evaluation, and then she would certify them as SAFER certified. But the problem is that a lot of these people had no experience with dogs. So they had evaluation, they knew the test, they knew how to do the test, they knew what they were supposed to do, but they wouldn't be able to tell you what the dog, they wouldn't be able to predict what the dog was going to do based on the dog's behavior, body language. And so if you're going to be an evaluator, if you're going to do any kind of handling of dogs, if you're going to be a dog walker, you should be able to read dog's body language, because if you can't, you're going to find out that what happens if you can't read dog's body language all the time. And actually, you know, this poodle, I was looking at this poodle and I'm going, I do not trust this dog. I do not like, I know he's bitten, so obviously that's in my head, but I just don't like the way he's looking. And then I start questioning myself. Am I letting what they said, you know, color the way I think? But I decided towards the end of the consultation, no, actually, I should be listening to myself here. This dog is not trustworthy. And that's where you're trying to get to. And I think that there are some people who think they know dogs and they don't really. And then there are people who are just at the very beginning and should understand that they're just at the beginning of learning about dog body language. The tester should not be the caretaker, if at all possible, because they become too attached, or they decide they don't like the dog and they want it to fail, although I doubt that that happens a whole lot of times. And then the other thing that's really important that I don't think many shelters can do, certainly not big shelters can do, is that you retest after a few days. If you've tested and the dog has not done well, then you retest. And if it's possible, you have somebody else do the retest to come up to see if there's another possibility. That, all by itself, the retesting that we used to do that I instituted at Marine Humane Society probably stopped most of the problems that a lot of other shelters had with volunteers getting really mad that the dogs were being... Because what happens is the volunteers would get used to walking a dog and they really liked the dog, and then we'd flunk the dog for whatever reason. And so we would always do a retest to give the dog another chance, and we'd invite the volunteers in to watch the retest. So, but that's what I don't know that they do. I don't know. Did they do that anymore?
No, because I do retest. I don't think we've ever invited volunteers.
Oh, we used to always, didn't we? We always.
Well, the ones that were vested in the dog,
yeah,
for sure. Because we want them to see what we're seeing and why we're saying we're not going to put this dog up for adoption. I think being honest with your volunteers is the way to go. I mean,
they I think Karen would probably talk to anybody, but we've never brought anybody in.
We used to bring in animal care techs. Because the animal care techs would go, I can't believe you just failed this dog.
Yeah.
And we'd go, okay, this is why we did. And we'd either video it occasionally, or we'd have them come in.
Yeah.
And then they'd leave going, okay, I get this. I understand why this happened.
Especially if you see the negative behavior, it gets into your brain way differently than just hearing about
it.
Yeah.
Totally different. The video.
I know at Peninsula Humane, there are always volunteers helping with the evals and everything, and you got to see a lot of what was going on, and they told you right from the get-go, before when you did your orientation, they said, you need to know that you should not get attached to these dogs, because some of these dogs are not going to make it. And you may think they're fine, but they may get euthanized, and you have to know that.
Yeah, I actually would disagree with you shouldn't get attached. I think people get attached.
Well, you do.
You have to cope with it.
You just have to learn to cope with that.
So that's what the thing they just said.
Yeah.
Some of these dogs are not going to make it, and you may come back and they're gone. And you have to understand.
Well, there were at Marin, there were volunteers who wanted to know what happened to the dogs, and there were volunteers who didn't want to.
Right.
And that you have to honor that completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's just because they wanted to think that the dogs all found homes.
And that's okay.
And that's great. They certainly didn't help in evaluations.
No.
Because that wasn't going to get them.